On a Friday, on the panel, Josie Pagani in Wellington. Josie, hello.
Hello.
In Auckland with me, Steve McCabe. Steve, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Nice to have you both here. Steve, Josie, Steve's written a book.
Yes, I saw that, actually, on your website, Steve.
Thank you.
So you went to his website.
I did.
Excellent.
I always like to find out about my enemies. Opposites.
Yes.
Colleague.
Colleagues, yes.
Colleague was the word you were driving
revealing
for.
A bad attitude.
Yes.
Tell us about your book.
Well, this is a book I started writing a few years ago after I had a rather disturbing experience back in the United States in the early 2000s. I spent an awful lot of money trying to reinvent myself as, of all things, an airline pilot. And I paid a lot of money to a flight school in Orlando, in Florida. And the idea was I get all my training and get my licenses and get a job flying a jet. It was going to be fantastic. Until about a year into a 10-month program, the owners of the school decided that they'd taken all the money out of it that they could, and so they shut the place down and ran off with tens of thousands of dollars of money that I was never going to see again. And I thought, well, I'm never going to get my money back, so the only way I can get a bit of revenge is by rewriting the story all by myself. So I've made a fictionalised account of it, which is now a novel called Crash Landing, which is now currently only available at my website, stevemccabe.net. Currently it's a digital download. I'm going to have it in paperback within the next fortnight or so. We're working on it at the moment. But we're doing something a bit different with it. Trying to get it published. Tried to go through the conventional route, submit it to agents. And these days it's getting harder and harder and harder to get an agent to bite. Digital downloads for things like your Kindle and your iPad are closing down the paper market an awful lot. And so unless you're writing the next Hunger Games or Harry Potter or, God forbid, 50 Shades of Grey, then no one wants to touch you, so I'm self-publishing.
Well, it's a good idea, self-publishing. Unlike your flying course, the novel's finished.
The novel is indeed finished.
Okay.
Available for download, $8.99.
Was this the same flying school? Just a series of quick questions about your novel.
Uh-huh.
That Muhammad Atta went to.
No, it wasn't. I did, eventually, after I got myself trained, I did actually teach as a flight instructor at Jones Aviation in Sarasota, where Muhammad Atta did learn to fly. But no, I never actually met the bloke. He was dead before I started flying.
Okay.
So why did you want to be a jet pilot?
What's
wrong with your present job?
High school teacher in South Auckland.
Right.
No, it's an ambition I've had since I was about that big, he says, holding his hand.
You know, there is
the ground.
You do reach an age where, I remember reaching the age where I suddenly realised, even if I wanted to, I could never be the lotto girl. You know, and it's that moment where you think,
Josie, that's sad.
I know. And
you
I'll probably never be
a
jetline pilot either.
You could still be the lotto girl.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah. Probably only you think that.
Oh, I'm a bit sad now. That's cast a glum pall over the entire hour.
Well, you could write a novel about you being the lotto girl.
And exactly. Call it Crash Landing.
Quite possibly, yes.
Can I ask one more quick question? Are you qualified to fly anything?
I am a commercial pilot, instrument rated on multi-engine planes. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Haven't flown in several years. It's just a very expensive hobby, but yes, I've got my licenses. I used to work as a flight instructor. I used to love it. Got about 500 hours under my belt.
You see, you got there in the end.
Oh, I got there, yeah. It's just, you know, as a flight instructor, you just can't make enough money to make a living, and that's the only way you can build up the hours in your logbook. And in the end, my wife and I sat down one evening about 8 years ago, had a very long conversation, and we said, we just can't sustain this any longer. So I packed it in, and then about 3 years later, the industry turned round, and suddenly they were back press-ganging people off the streets to fly.
And now you're making millions as a high school teacher. Not.
Yeah. Yes. Millions of what exactly? Enemies?
Brownie points to get into heaven.
Well, oh yes, God owes me sins at this point.
Interesting to hear about panellists' lives and employment problems. Josie Pagani, what have you been up to, please?
Oh, well, talking of very expensive sports, I love skiing, and I love that phrase. It's the only sport where you spend an arm and a leg to break an arm and a leg. And so I've just taken the kids skiing in between my work as a communications consultant and various other things. But it's a great sport. I love it. But it is hell of an expensive. And I skied last year during the election campaign when I was campaigning. And the highlight for me was skiing off the mountain. This is at Ruapehu at Whakapapa. Skiing off the mountain straight into the offices of the Ruapehu Alpine List to have a meeting with them about their issues.
Very
dressed
stylish.
In my ski gear.
Very
yes.
stylish.
And they got excited for about 30 seconds that I might be the first local MP who actually skied on a mountain, until they realised I was the Labour candidate and it was the safest national seat in the country, or one of them. it's going up there again. I went up, this was last week in the school holidays, and it made me realise that it's an incredible example, a model of how it can work. We've been talking about the ownership of water for weeks, haven't we? And that those mountains and Lake Taupo, with all the water in it, were the ownership of those were recognised, I think, in 1887 by local Māori. And local Māori, this is Te Wharetoa, gifted it back to the Crown. Mm. As a result, fast forward to today, when we go skiing, every time they need to build a chairlift, a ski lift or something, or something else onto the ski field, they have to go through this lengthy consultation period with local Māori, just as it should be. And like any relationship, any marriage, if you like, it takes time, and someone gets a huff and wanders off for a while, and then they come back and bring each other flowers and they do a deal and they build the ski lift. It's a really good working relationship. It's real, and it's a model of how that can work. So the ownership is recognised, but you can still have a private company like Ruapehu Alpine Lifts who move on the mountain and make some money out of it, but do it in consultation.
All right. So you're saying co-governance is our future. It is our future. It's a given. Get used to it.
Well, exactly. Yeah, and you could, and recognising ownership isn't a barrier to making for foreign, well, they're not foreign, but for private companies coming in and making some money.
But I'd like to know who owns the snow.
Well, yes, therein lies the issue, isn't it? Because that's been a huge barrier to the discussion. It's the silliest thing I've heard over the water. I mean, of course the water, someone said the water in 1840 is different to the water now. Well, of course it is. I mean, so's the soil, actually, if you think about it. The fish in the sea are different to the ones in 1840. But I think the ownership of
not always
the mountain is, well,
what it depends which fish and chip shop you go to.
If you come across one of those very old eels, it might be the same. But I thought it was very interesting. And then imagine if the crown, who now has that as a national park, decided to sell the Tongariro Crossing to an overseas company and who would charge $300.
Now you're talking.
Then you'd be thinking, if you were local Māori, about that gift we gave you 150 years ago. I think we might be taking it back.
So. I wouldn't have minded a chairlift up the Tongariro Crossing, actually, from memory. Would Crash Landing be a good title for your skiing style or not? You can't punch it at Steve McCabe's.
I'm going to quote Pam Corkery here, who once said that I am not as bad as I think I am, neither am I as good as I think I am, and that's how I would describe my skiing. I'm fast and rough.
Josie, are you a snowboarder or a skier?
I'm a skier, and it's partly that I look at snowboarders as those algorithm pop musicians. It all looks a bit modern and young for me. I prefer to perfect my skiing.
The Lotto Girl on the panel today, Josie Pagani and Steve McCabe with her. Let's talk about donations first. The calls go on for the Prime Minister to dump John Banks as a minister, after a police investigation cleared him of electoral finances offences, but found he personally solicited large donations he later declared as anonymous. Mike Williams will join us shortly. Police say their investigations into whether he knowingly filed a false electoral return found insufficient evidence to consider a prosecution, and they were unable to consider other charges because they were laid too late, the complaints laid too late. Now, the Greens in particular keeping up a chorus of calls, you know, to dump Banksy. How great a transgression is this really in the context of what they've all done over the years in terms of electoral finance shenanigans?
It's pretty bad, Jim. I mean, I had to declare every single little donation that I had in the last election. If I got $2,000, for example, from a high profile judge who donated to my campaign, you declare that. And the reason you declare it is that it's not so much the amount of money, it's who's giving it. It matters. It matters who might potentially be buying influence. And what the point here, I mean, this is the Local Electoral Act, actually, and that act is in the dock big time. I mean, that law is clearly a mess, and it's different to national elections where you are you have to be a lot more open about your anonymous donations. But what happened here? John Banks asked for the money, clearly. He accepted it in person. Then he conveniently forgot it. Then he said, oh, no, but it wasn't me collecting the money and talking to people about it. It was somebody else, which clearly it wasn't, because he received the $15,000 in a sealed envelope from Sky City. So he's lied. And I think we're setting the bar a little low for our politicians when we say, look, it's fine. He's not in jail. He'd make a great cabinet minister.
And also, let's be fair, Jim, you're saying, you know, is it any worse than what everyone else has done? Well, I'm suddenly hearing the voice of my mother saying, and if everyone else is jumping off a bridge, would you do it too? Simply because that's the standard that's been set. Does that mean that we have to say, oh, well, if another, somebody else, in this case, a cabinet minister is doing it, oh, well, fair enough, then that's okay.
Nevertheless, do you have to single out Banksy if everybody else is doing it?
Yeah, why not?
All right.
It's John Banks, after all.
Okay.
Definitely.
You want to say something before we get Mike Williams on?
Well, I was just going to say John Key's in a bind here because he said he's made it clear from the beginning, John Banks hasn't broken the law or the rules, therefore I've got no reason to act and I'm standing by him. Except that everybody knows in the court of public opinion that he did do something wrong and he was a bit shady and he did lie, but John Key's still got to stand by him. If he had any guts at all, I think John Key should say, right, we're going to reform that local electoral act, we're going to change it so this can never happen again. But he's stuck because then that's sort of implicit admission that John Banks did do something wrong. But he needs to do something.
And also, to be fair, how dependent upon John Banks and ACT is the national government? You get the impression to a certain extent that John Key considers himself beholden unto John Banks. I mean, look at the example with charter schools, for example. That was clearly a bone that was thrown to Banks. OK, fine, we'll get you in the cabinet as long as you stay in our, basically, a de facto coalition here, keep the government going, and we'll give you what you need. Is it possible that if Key suddenly stands Banks down now, Banks is going to say, fine, I'm taking my ball, I'm going to go play somewhere else, and this could make a mess of the national government?
Let's get Mike Williams on. In terms of the size of the transgressions, a former president, of course, of the New Zealand Labour Party and one of our panellists, Mike Williams, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, Mr. Banks personally solicited, as Josie said, the large donations later declared as anonymous. But to put it all in context, how does it declare with, I mean, how does it compare with all the situations we've discussed in the past, not directly comparable, but Winston and Owen Glenn, Labour and the Leaders Fund? Can you think back and tell us to what extent you think this is a bad situation?
I think this is particularly bad, and I'd like to correct one of your panellists. Everyone is not doing it, and there's an egregious mistake in the New Zealand Herald this morning where a columnist said after expat millionaire Owen Glenn revealed embarrassing details of his anonymous donations to both Labor and Winston Peters back in 2008. Now, that is just simply not true. The Owen Glenn donations were declared immediately by the Labor Party. I was there. I did it. And the donation to Winston was not a donation to Winston. It was actually a donation to his legal team to fight the Tauranga electoral petition. So this is not run-of-the-mill. This is very weird behaviour. I mean, I was a fundraiser for the Labor Party, and then 20 years later I was president of the Labor Party, and I never tripped across this law because I had a very clear understanding, and I think it's really common sense, Jim, that if you knew who gave you money, then it could not be anonymous.
I think this is the Local Electoral Act, isn't it, Mike? And I think there's a slightly different definition of anonymous donation in the Local Electoral Act compared to the National Electoral Act. And that needs to change. I think because, in other words, you can get away with saying it was anonymous if you've had a discussion with a potential donator and you've talked to them about how they might potentially hypothetically donate money to a particular account, just hypothetically. You can get away with saying that was anonymous because you didn't actually ask for the money. So, I mean, clearly that electoral act has to change, doesn't it?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I mean, the situation where the CEO of the casino sticks an envelope in John Banks's hands and he then declares the $15,000 inside that envelope as anonymous, to me, is dancing on the head of a pin. I mean, what did he think was in the envelope? A birthday card?
And did he not open the envelope himself?
But, well, of course. I mean, that's the first thing you do when you get outside, isn't it?
But in terms of dancing on the head of a pin, Mike, I mean, it's apples and bananas here because every episode is different and our memories dim on details. But didn't you, regarding the pledge card, once say, for example, that it was always known it was election spending?
Yes, and so it was. And I'd point out there that Labor used that pledge card twice, and it was signed off by the Auditor General before the third time he decided it was an electoral spending. Now, our understanding of what was not electoral spending at the time, and this had been our understanding for, well, as long as I've been involved in politics, is if you didn't say vote Labor, if you didn't say give money to Labor, then it was not attributable as an electoral expense. Now, the Auditor General changed the rules after the event. He moved the goalposts, so we were quite justified, I think, in being quite aggrieved about that.
He said at the time, didn't he made a point of getting in touch with all of you to warn you, etc. I mean, there was dispute about to what extent he gave Labor fair warning.
Well, he never gave me any warning. I think his name was Kevin McGrath, something like that. I never had any discussions with him at all. So if he gave warning, it certainly wasn't to me.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, Mike's absolutely right. There's a reason, you know, big donations shouldn't be anonymous. And there's a very good reason for that, as I said. I mean, you need to know who is potentially influencing politicians. And that's why a lot of the big donors, a lot of the big banks or other organisations will give similar amounts to each party, so because they know it's going to be declared.
Okay, Mike Williams, you're quite right to make the point that everyone's not doing it. But are a lot of people historically in New Zealand from all sorts of parties doing a version of it? Would that be a fairer question?
Look, I can only speak for my tenure as a fundraiser and president of the Labor Party. I never did anything like that. And it wasn't just the Electoral Act that would worry me. It was Section 111 of the Crimes Act, where if you knew somebody had given you money and you signed a declaration that you didn't know they'd given you money, then that is a false declaration, and it's actually punishable by 3 years in jail. So that was the kind of discipline I knew about. And I would say I consider that John Banks could still be open to that kind of charge.
But I think John Banks has been a bit cowardly, to be perfectly honest. He's now trying to say that the return was compiled by a campaign volunteer. So he's saying, oh, I didn't know what was in it. I just signed it. Which either A, he's been a bit cowardly, he's trying to throw a volunteer under the bus, saying, oh, it's this guy's fault instead. Or he's saying, well, I'm so slack and lazy, I don't bother reading the forms I put in front of me to sign, even when they are very, very high-stakes forms such as this one.
Well, the truth is, under the legislation, the police can only look for evidence that he knowingly filed a false return. So they're completely stymied, really. That's the only thing they can look at. What they can't do is say, yes, he asked for the money, yes, he accepted it in person, and yes, he lied, which is actually what happened by the looks of it.
If everyone's not doing it, nevertheless, Mike, over your years in Parliament, has there been enough precedent set in terms of using some fairly smart and fancy footwork to get around declarations or to try and find inventive ways to get campaign funding in? So, in fact, it has created a climate where people try and essentially get away with the letter of the law.
Well, I think what comes out of all this debate is there has to be a rewrite of both the Local Government Electoral Act, whatever that's called, and the Electoral Act, because there were quite clearly holes you can drive lorries through. I mean, years ago, I discovered, for example, that the Prime Minister, John Key, was enrolled at a place he didn't live at. He was involved in Waikuku Valley Road, but he lived in Parnell, Remuera, then Parnell, and I thought that was against the Electoral Act, but it turns out that it possibly wasn't, because you could enrol at a place you intended to live at. Now, you know, that meant I could intend to live in a marginal seat and enrol there while still living at my real home. So I think there's a lot of loopholes that need a rewrite, but I don't think it's the politicians that should do that. I think it should be put to an independent body to have a good look at it and have a look at how these rorts are being perpetrated and close the gaps. That's what's happened in Australia years ago, and it should happen here, in my view.
All right, Mike, thank you. Mike Williams, former president of the New Zealand Labor Party, 26 minutes past four. Steve McCabe with Josie Pagani. An Auckland law professor makes the point today that an inquest is a very different thing from a murder trial, and a coroner's determination cannot decide guilt on a criminal charge. Professor Warren Brookbanks was responding to questions about a possible inquest into the suspicious death of Fielding farmer Scott Guy, whose brother-in-law Ewan MacDonald was found not guilty of his murder. And a recent inquest, as we know, into the deaths of Chris and Crew Kahui found their father, Chris Kahui, to have been the only other person present when the babies suffered their fatal injuries, and Chris Kahui acquitted on a charge of murdering them in 2008. People seem to have leapt to conclude from this that the coroner's court panel is the final repository of truth after Gary Evans pointed the finger in a very certain way to a particular individual, don't they?
Well, the coroner's inquest, they can look at the cause of death, and they can look at whether or not steps need to be taken to prevent similar kinds of deaths in the future. They can't say who was criminally responsible, and the whole focus is on the balance of probability, as you've said, and versus the beyond reasonable doubt in the criminal court. But the reason that you have to pass a higher level in a criminal court is that you're potentially locking someone up for life. So you cannot get it wrong, or you must make sure as far as you can to your ability that you're not getting it wrong. And I think although people get, the frustration people feel about the Chris Kahui case, about the Ewan McDonald case and so forth, that they're feeling like, well, why can't we just go to something like the coroner's inquest, where it is a quest after truth rather than the need to find beyond a reasonable doubt that someone's guilty. But I think there are all sorts of fish hooks there, that we have a system that is there to make sure that we don't lock up the wrong people.
Yeah, but is it a two-tier system? I mean, and although there are a few examples as yet of that, but Professor Brookbank saying he had no criticism of Mr. Evans's findings in the Kahui case, did have concern that the coroner appeared to be pointing the finger in a very certain way to a particular individual.
Mm. Well, and the other thing to bear in mind with that is that coroners can get it wrong, and I think they got it wrong, the coroner got it wrong when he pointed the finger at the Good Samaritans who helped Irene Asher, who was the teenager who ended up drowning.
Saying they contributed to a death.
Yes. Yeah, okay. So, you know, you've got, in the coroner's system, you've got the coroner in a court, you're tried by 12 peers who have to find beyond a reasonable doubt that you're guilty.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Jonathan Tim joining us shortly, the president of the New Zealand Law Society. You want to say something before he comes on?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think what's really going on here is there's, in a lot of people's minds, in a case like this, there is a need for somebody to be held accountable. Somebody has to be found guilty. Somebody has to be deemed to have been responsible for this. And when you get cases where, rightly or wrongly, the public has decided, and there's a very, very strong opinion that says that a particular individual is guilty of this particular murder, then when that individual is then acquitted by a jury, then there is a sense of unfinished business. And somehow there is an urge to have this person held to account one way or another. Another classic example from the US back in the 90s would be O.J. Simpson. Everybody was convinced, except for a very small number who sat on his jury, that he was as guilty as sin. He was found not guilty, and there was huge uproar. But then he was then taken to a civil trial. He was sued for, I believe, infringing the civil liberties of the two alleged victims who officially he didn't kill. And I mean, he's all but admitted that he did it afterwards.
And the family sued him.
And the family sued. They sued him in a civil trial, and he was then found civilly liable for their deaths, even though he was acquitted of their murder. And so, as a result, justice was seen to have been served because somebody was seen to have been found responsible for the deaths of the two.
Can I ask Jonathan Tim about that idea of finished business and that impulse? Jonathan Tim, president of the New Zealand Law Society. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
G'day, Jim. How are you?
Good, and thank you for coming on. Are we seeing a kind of a finished business impulse newly emerging in our courts, Jonathan, at all?
Well, I think it travels by a number of names. I mean, what you are seeing, Jim, is a sense of injustice. People have a sense of injustice, and you see it in communities all around the world. It's a very common human trait. And when people feel that something has gone wrong, you generally get this upwelling and outpouring of a sense of injustice.
Okay.
So, that's what we've got, and it's understandable too, because people feel in some way the system has misfired because they have two competing answers for the same problem, and they're trying to determine which is the more appropriate.
In terms of justice, achieving justice, Jonathan, in the public mind at least, a lot of people don't see any reason, for example, why Ewan McDonald shouldn't have been put on the stand. And you have to ask the question once again, because this conversation isn't going away, in terms of achieving more satisfactory resolutions in court generally, is the right to silence, generally, stymieing justice in any shape or form?
Well, I wouldn't hold that view, but then many people and listeners in your panel would probably say, well, that's typical of a lawyer. So let's come back to brass tacks, which is this. we should welcome the opportunity to have a discussion about our justice system and look at it and see if there's ways in which it can be improved. And I'm sure I can speak for every lawyer who says, let's have that discussion. But like most lawyers, I want it to be a rational and intelligent and an objective debate, and I don't want it to be the kind of rabid mob that we've sort of got on some other talkback shows that you hear, which is just ill-informed and misinformed and quite wrong in its content. So we welcome, let's have a debate, let's look at it in an objective way.
But, you know, the right to... Sorry, yeah, carry on.
The next part is around the sense of injustice. I mean, there's a huge amount of heat in this right now, and that's exactly the wrong time to be making the decision.
Yeah.
Let's just let the heat die out of it. Let's sit back a little bit and try and be a little bit objective about things.
Nevertheless, the chief coroner says, you know, he, Gary Evans, had an advantage the criminal court didn't have, that Chris Kahui actually gave evidence, which says to a lot of people...
Jim, let's look at it in the round. The coroner also heard a lot of other evidence in an entirely different framework and focused on a different set of issues. So this causative link that everyone says, if Kahui had been made to give evidence in his criminal trial, the outcome would have been different from what it was, is quite wrong.
And don't forget, I mean, the right to silence dates back to the days when you could be tortured and forced to speak, and so therefore you are going to potentially convict somebody who's not guilty, or you're going to potentially get a false confession. So the right to silence is something that has been sacrosanct in the legal system, and judges usually will say to the jury, you can interpret it as you like. If the defendant refuses to stand up there and say why they didn't do something, and if they remain silent, it's like, you know, my son has chocolate all over his face, and I say, who ate the chocolate cake? And he says, I'm remaining silent, I'm not going to say anything. He looks guilty.
But a jury can form conclusions about that, whether or not the defendant's in the dock testifying or whether the defendant doesn't testify, surely.
Well, I think we need to be cautious there. In the criminal justice system, juries are directed by the judge, and it's the law in New Zealand, that you're not to draw an adverse inference against somebody who exercises their right to silence. What's the point of having a right? And then if you exercise it, an adverse inference can be drawn against you. So you just need to be a little cautious about that. That's not my experience, and I've done dozens and dozens and dozens of criminal trials. What I'm more concerned about is this, the connection in our community at the moment, that if we make one change over here, suddenly everything's going to be okay. All the right results are going to come about. I don't accept that as a proposition. I think I'm more persuaded by the old adage in our community, which says, hard cases make bad law. And this is a hard case. There's no winners here. There's no satisfactory outcome. People go away unhappy. And perhaps the McDonald case might be in the same vein, although I suspect it's not. And so if we now rush to making law, the law society would say that this is the wrong response.
Yeah, no. Well, even if you, Jonathan, don't rush to making law. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, but even if you don't rush to making law, isn't it the very white-hot nature of these discussions that will actually produce, if it does, the change in law when heads are cooler?
Well, maybe, Jim, but if when heads are cooler, a lot of other factors come into play. And one of the things that comes into play is, well, what's the genesis of the rule? Well, why do we have the right to silence? Your panellist spoke a moment ago about the history that we've in fact forced confessions out of people in the past, and we've executed on the basis of it and later found out it was completely false. And I'm here to tell you, Jim, people make false confessions today, and they do it on a regular basis. Now, that may surprise people, but people actually do admit things that they didn't do. Now, there's a range of reasons for that, and the culpability might vary from homicides down to driving while intoxicated or whatever, but you know, you've got to just stand back and look at things in the round. And also, you know, you'd invite callers and say, look, if our system works so well, how come we have convictions for people who are completely innocent? What do you say about the Arthur Allen Thomas case, or the David Doherty case, or the case of Aaron Farmer? These people were convicted and later proved to be completely innocent. So, look, we all accept the system is not correct. Let's have a debate about it, but let's just be a little bit more rational about how we leap from one stone to the next, because abolishing the right to silence is a very, very significant step. And I was thinking about it in preparation for your call, Jim, because I want you to think about this. Who do you think in our community can start a criminal case? The answer is anyone. not just the police or any other prosecutorial authority. Anybody in our community can start a criminal case. So I could start a case against you, Jim, and I could make you come down to court, and I can make you go into the stand and then begin to start challenging you about all manner of things. Now, how do you feel about that? And where's your right to silence in the face of those kinds of allegations? So people need to be very cautious about pulling up very fundamental structure of our criminal justice system without thinking more carefully about where that all leads to.
It's an interesting discussion. I'd like to carry it on, but we're going over time a bit. Jonathan Tem, thank you, President of the New Zealand Law Society.